Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. You're in for a very important intelligence briefing, I think, by one of the most intelligent people I know, a woman I had the privilege of meeting decades ago when we worked in the United States Senate together. She's gone on to many and better things. She has served her country in a variety of capacities in the Defense Department, the National Security Council. She has been a Fox News host. She has been an author, including most recently, of her book Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. And she is one of the most gifted commentators on the present scene that we have in the country today. And she's also an old friend, of course. Her name is K.T. McFarlane, and she is graciously giving us an hour of her time today to talk about a whole host of subjects that I think you'll find informative and compelling. And I've been looking forward to this for a long time. So, K.T., welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us.
It's great to be with you. And Frank, I really want to just thank you for that lovely introduction, but also to say thank you for decades of service to the country and of even pursuing things when the rest of the world said, oh, he's crazy. And yet you turned out to be right. You know, you've really done a great service to the nation. And I'm proud of our association for, God, I don't even want to think about it, 40 years. You're a great man.
Thank you, Kitty. That's very generous of you. I'm fond of saying that I'd rather be wrong, honestly, about most of these prognoses. And I think you probably feel the same way. But unfortunately, we're vindicated on a lot of them. Let's talk a little bit about your personal story, KT, because, of course, you were, as I mentioned, one of the first people brought to a senior position by Donald Trump when he became president of the United States as the deputy national security advisor to Michael Flynn. You were also one of the first casualties of the war that we've now had, I think, fairly thoroughly revealed that was waged against him, both as a candidate, as a president-elect, and then assiduously during his presidency, something that, well, continues to this day, even after he's left office in the form of an impeachment trial in the Senate. Talk a little bit about what happened to you, what your personal story says about the larger drama that, as I say, is still very much playing out.
Well, you know, Frank, the thing that's, as I look back on it, the thing that just strikes me is that I was not a rookie to government. I'd been in government before. I knew how the manipulations and the interagencies and how it all works. And even I was taken by surprise. I mean, a couple of weeks, 2 weeks into the Trump administration, I get the national security advisor's assistant for the media guy comes into my office and says, we have a problem. And I said, close the door. What's the problem? And he said, well, it turns out that General Flynn, who had had a conversation with the Russian ambassador during the transition, which was perfectly legitimate. None of us listened to the conversation, but it was, he should have had that conversation. If he didn't, he would have been doing malpractice. And anyway, so the aide says, well, the Washington Post has a transcript of this phone call. I said, transcript? What is, that's got to be the most highly classified document there is. I didn't even know a transcript existed. And so how did this happen? Who's wiretapping the national security advisor? How come the Washington Post has a copy of this transcript? And what the heck does the transcript say? And why is this such an issue? Anyway, it turns out that the Washington Post did have a transcript, or somebody had read the transcript to them. And they were using that, particularly because nobody else had seen the transcript. Nobody in the government had seen the transcript. Nobody in the Trump administration. And they were lying about it. And they were making it into something it wasn't. And then they were using that as a way to get to General Flynn and the rest of us with the idea of getting to President Trump. And the way Justice Department, and particularly later the Mueller investigation, did it was that they used what are called perjury traps. So they come to you, and they came to me. They knocked on my door several months after I'd left the Trump administration in 2017, and they knocked on my door and said, "Can we come in?" And I said, "Yeah, what are you doing?" And they said, "We want to find out what the Russians did to interfere with the 2016 election." And I said, "Well, I'd like to know, too, because as a patriot, I want to make sure the Russians or nobody else gets an opportunity to interfere with our electoral process." So I'm in good faith meeting with them. And the whole time they were setting perjury traps. A perjury trap is when they ask you a question, Frank, about, well, what happened on this phone call? And you don't remember. And you say, well, can I have a copy of the records? Where's my phone log? And they said, well, we can't give that to you. And I certainly didn't have it. And so it's like they have the answer code and then they start quizzing you on things. And the minute you trip up and you get, when you think the phone call was at 7 o'clock when it was really at 3 o'clock, then they say, well, that's a lie. You know, you should have remembered. And so we're going to charge you with perjury. And that's what they were setting me up. That's what they did with General Flynn. They knew the answers, but they thought if they could trick you into saying something incorrect by total accident on your part or bad memory, that they could then go after you and say, well, that you've lied. Now you have to prove that you're innocent. And by the way, you're going to have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more, hiring attorneys to represent you. So what they try to force you to do is either say I'm guilty, to plead guilty to a crime you didn't commit, or, and in this case, the more sinister one, is to get you to implicate other people in crimes that they did not commit. And what they wanted from me was to implicate Donald Trump in things that he hadn't done, and I wouldn't do it. And I knew I faced bankruptcy and reputational ruin and everything else, but I'm very proud of myself and particularly my husband, who said, you can't lie, even if it's to save yourself. You've got to do the right thing.
KT, this is such a morality tale, really, and it reflects, I think, both well on you and your husband, Alan, great American patriot, but also speaks volumes about, well, Bill Clinton called it the politics of personal destruction, that we're very much at work and being institutionalized during this period within agencies of the United States government, including the FBI. And clearly, as we all now know, Michael Flynn fell victim to this sort of practice when he, in good faith, met with the FBI. And it just is important to understand, folks, that this hasn't ended. The same kinds of activities are still afoot. Who got the transcript? You said, KT, that nobody in the Trump administration has it. I'm not sure that was true. I suspect that the NSA had it, and I suspect that other people in the intelligence community had it. Well, I think there were people who would be nominally Trump officials. And this is really such an important piece of the story, is Donald Trump's administration, as you know better than just about anybody, was riddled with people who were nominally Trump officials and yet who loathed this president, who wanted to facilitate his political destruction and sought, you know, his defeat in terms of policies. And we're going to talk about policies at length in the coming segments. But I just want to set the stage for this by saying you were given a front row seat. In fact, you were an early, as I say, casualty of what is still going on today. And we're going to talk more about it with KT McFarland on the other side of this short break. We'll be right back.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back visiting with KT McFarland, the author, among other works, of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. It's a part memoir of her own personal experiences and travails, which we were just discussing, and part an insider's view of America First, what Donald Trump set out to do, and, a tale of an amazing degree of accomplishment, all things considered. And KT, just to finish that point, all things considered means taking into account the fact that this president arrived in office with you and a handful of others and practically nobody else. And our friend Steve Bannon likes to say the original sin of the administration was that it turned over the keys of populating the senior ranks of the government to Reince Priebus, sort of a creature of the establishment, who became the White House chief of staff and who had a lot of establishment Republicans, worked in some cases in other administrations, but were not particularly aligned with Donald Trump to ostensibly carry out his policies. And then on top of that, a whole host of, you know, Democratic holdovers from the Obama ranks. Talk a little bit from your collective experience going back to the Reagan years with respect to one of the Gipper's, you know, old and very, I think, time-tested adages, which is personnel is policy. What difference did it make that Trump had so many people who were really not on his team, nonetheless supposedly working for him?
Well, they were sabotaging it from within. And normally when a new president comes into office, he already has a couple thousand people who have been advising him during the campaign, who are going to immediately fill the offices that are vacated by the departing administration. We've seen in the Biden administration, a couple thousand people have moved right into the offices and they start executing things for Donald Trump because he was not a traditional Republican. And because he was a populist as opposed to traditional Republicans who are all about status quo and big government and foreign policies that they were perpetuating, you know, wars in the Middle East that we couldn't possibly win. They wanted to either be in government so that they could subvert Trump, or if not in those positions themselves, then attack politics of personal destruction, all the people who were in the Trump administration. And so the difficult thing was, you know, I think when the president walked in, President Trump walked into office, he assumed it was like buying a company, right? You buy a company, you walk in, and you then control the company. And if the people who work for you are the holdovers, if you don't like them, you fire them. And if they don't, if they try to do something against you, you fire them, or they quit. And when President Trump didn't understand, he couldn't fire everybody. And he needed a couple thousand people to have these jobs. So he was sort of stuck with the people who had been there before. And what they did was they undermined his policies at every single step. Because at that point, it wasn't a difference between Republicans and Democrats. Traditional Republicans and Democrats, they're the same party. And they believed, they didn't believe in America First. They didn't believe in populism. They thought they were much smarter than the American people. And they could govern in 2016. So they were going to obliterate the mistake by making sure Donald Trump was stopped at every step, whether it was sabotaging his policies or whether it was going after his administration with the Mueller investigation, whether it was impeachment. You know, we can go on and on and on about all the ways they tried to do it.
Let me turn, though, before dwelling on this further, because it does tie in directly to what's happening at the moment, of course, a very similar kind of pursuit of the destruction of Donald Trump, politically, at the very least, to talk about his accomplishments, specifically given the focus of this program in the foreign policy and national security arena in which you've spent most of your professional life, KT. It's astonishing, really, to look back at it and see what he was able to do despite these obstacles, the efforts to, you know, bring charges against him, impeach him, undermine him at every turn, and then, as you say, to have those responsible for executing his policies who were largely in revolt against them. Talk a bit about the America First agenda as you helped set it in train and what it did accomplish in, you know, the various quarters of the world in which we face real challenges that were made, I think, in at least most cases, considerably better by those policies that you advocated.
Yeah, I think President Trump's administration was the most significantly successful in foreign policy, really, since going back to Reagan. President Trump actually called me over the weekend and we had a long talk. And we talked about, he said, you know, you understood, he was very generous to me with compliments. And he said, you understood from the very beginning what we were all about, what America First meant. You helped create the policies. And he said, you understood that it was important to have energy independence from the Middle East and to fix the economy. And I think that when President Trump, by deregulation and by tax cuts and by encouraging the fracking industry in the United States, we had the best economy we've really ever had in our history. And that gave us leverage over a lot of other things that we could do internationally. So America First meant put our interests first. Don't continue to try to build up China at our expense in hopes that China was going to be a nice trading partner. It wasn't going to work. The Chinese were doing just the opposite. And don't continue to subsidize the security arrangements with our NATO allies and our Asian allies, as we've done for 30 or 40 or 70 years, because A, they don't need it. Their economies are doing just fine. And B, we can't afford it. And so America First was to say the world has changed. This is not the world of the last 70 years. It's a different world where the Chinese ascendant, China wants to replace the United States as the dominant world power, and European and other nations who can afford to pay their fair share and do not need to have their economies subsidized. It was, you know, this whole establishment had been built up over 70 years in the post-war period of doing things a certain way. And when President Trump came in and said, no, we're going to do it differently now. We're going to respect the rise of these other countries, but also respect, we don't need to subsidize everybody. We shouldn't be subsidizing everybody. We're going broke subsidizing everybody. And that was the thing that upset the apple cart, because all these people had vested interests, financial and otherwise, in keeping the game going. But the game was over. They just didn't realize it.
Well, and there's probably no more vivid example of upsetting the apple cart than Donald Trump's change, as you say, with respect to the Chinese Communist Party and how business as usual had been pursued up to that point. You captured the essence of it very well, that if we just make them richer, they'll be more like us and we'll get along. We'll compete, yes, but we'll basically all be part of one big, happy, civilized international community. But Donald Trump said it isn't working. It won't work in the future. It's making things worse, in fact. And he changed course rather dramatically. And, you know, I'm so happy to hear that he actually called you to thank you. That I don't think is something he's always remembered for, but it's deserved in this case.
And no, we do talk from time to time. And it was funny, Frank. He said, you know, Kitchy, you know, thank you for saying nice things about me. And then he paused and he said, well, you don't always say nice things about me, but thank you for saying nice things about our policy.
Well, talk a little bit about the China policy, KT. You had as a mentor early on in your long career in government Henry Kissinger, and there was probably no more important figure in promoting this policy of engagement, as he had been, you know, promoting the policy of engagement known as détente with the Soviet Union in years previous to this. He seems to have gotten this monstrously wrong, I think it's fair to say, and still, I think, clings to it. But Donald Trump, who, you know, did listen to him on occasion, saw this very differently, and it seemed to have made all the difference for the time.
When we had the opening to China, I mean, now we're going back to the 1970s, I think it made sense then. But the problem was that we looked at the world, and we looked at China particularly, the way we had looked at other countries. So, for example, after World War II, we helped rebuild the German economy at our expense. We underwrote their security at our expense. We did the same with Japan and Korea, with the idea that, well, once they became prosperous nations, they would be competitors, like you said, competitors for sure, but we wouldn't go to war with each other. We'd all play by the same rules of the road, and we would be, you know, prosperous trading partners in peace and prosperity forever. China didn't do what we thought they would do. And Donald Trump was the first president, the first leader, to say, wait a minute, this isn't working. The Chinese are not becoming fair competitors. They are cheating at every step of the way. They are exploiting our generosity. They have no intention of living peacefully and harmoniously under the rules of order of the world. They have every intention of changing the rules of the order, of the world order, when they become in a position to do it. So we got to change course now. We've got to stand up to them. And that was the big difference, that the Chinese didn't do what we expected them. And Trump, as a realist, he said, okay, they're not doing it, let's change course. Everybody else in Washington, Republicans, Democrats, Henriques, everybody, they all said, well, we'll keep doing what we've been doing before in hopes that maybe someday it'll change. And it won't ever. It'll only get worse. The difference between where China was 20 years ago, when we could have stood up to them, when Joe Biden, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he should have stood up to the Chinese. He didn't. They caved at every single opportunity. And the Chinese now, they think that they're now an inevitably ascendant nation, and the United States is in permanent decline. And so even in the last 2 or 3 weeks, the Chinese have been moving out smartly to basically to take control of the world.
We're going to take a break here in just a second, KT, but I want to come back to this point because I think it's so central to the differences between the Trump administration and the new Biden administration. Is managed decline actually now, once again, the policy of the United States government, meaning our decline? And if so, what are the implications of that, not just with respect to China, but other nations around the world who have been aligned with us or who have been hostile to us? And what does all that mean for the American people? We'll talk about that and much more with KT McFarland, the author of Revolution, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're speaking with KT McFarland, a friend of mine for many years, I'm happy to say, and a great contributor, both as a public servant and as a public speaker and analyst and commentator on a whole variety of platforms. We're always delighted to have her here at Secure Freedom Radio. And KT, thank you again for giving us an hour of your time to have this freewheeling conversation about Trump and Biden and where we find ourselves headed at the moment in terms particularly of the national security and the common weal. We were talking about several of the features of the Trump national security foreign policy characterized by this term America First. One other one that I think one other facet, I should say, of all of that that I think warrants some particular mention here, particularly as we pivot to the conversation about what Joe Biden is up to, is the Trump legacy, his record with respect to the Middle East, starting with his extraordinary, courageous act of actually doing what he promised to do by moving the embassy of the United States from Tel Aviv to Israel's capital, Jerusalem. Talk a bit about the Trump policy and what he bequeathed to Joe Biden as a result of it.
We were early on in the administration, maybe like the first or second week. We were in the White House Situation Room. The president wasn't there, but Jared Kushner and several others. And we were talking about Middle East policy. And it was pretty clear that the Middle East policy of previous administrations, again, Republican and Democrat, which always started with the Palestinians, that we had to solve the Palestinian problem before we could ever get to peace in the Middle East. And Jared Kushner, to his enormous credit, and here's a guy who's not an experienced foreign policy person, but an experienced businessman. And he said, well, I think we should take a different approach in the Middle East. He said, there are all the Arab countries, you know, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, UAE, Bahrain, all of them. He said, they all have a new generation of leaders who are in their 30s. They've all been educated in the West. They're comfortable with modern society. They're comfortable with modern economies. And I think we should focus our attention on that generation. And the rest of us were sort of, the rest of us who were much older than Jared Kushner said, well, no, you child. And he said, no, but look, he said, the populations of these countries, the majority of them have their population are under the age of 35. So to the people in those countries, they don't look at leaders who are their same age group and contemporary. They don't think they're young, they think they're the right age. They look at the older generation and think they're over the hill. So that's why the focus in the Arab world was always on that next generation who were not radicals, who did not believe in terrorism, who were not radical fundamentalists. At the same time, we knew that we had to go to the Israelis and give them the political breathing room they needed to convince their own people to make peace with the Arabs. And the biggest symbol of that was by moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and it showed the Israeli people that, well, this is serious. And at the time when the embassy was moved, all the traditionalists in Washington said, oh, woe is me, we're going to have World War III in the Middle East.
The Arab street would rise.
They would rise. It would be, you know, be horrible. But it turned out not to be the case. It was barely a whimper. And it was by doing that for the Israelis, by moving the embassy, which presidents, God, going back 40 years, apparently did it until Donald Trump. And by courting the younger generation of Arab leaders, Gulf Arab leaders, then Kushner was able to craft a peace agreement between them. Why? Because in the Middle East, as you know, the expression, an enemy of my enemy is my friend. And the Israelis and the Gulf Arabs, Saudi Arabia, et cetera, they looked at Iran as the greatest threat to the region. Iran's support of terrorism, Iran's nuclear weapons ambition, and Iran's constant threats to, you know, death to everybody, death to Israel, death to America, death to the Saudis. And so Kushner was able to broker a peace agreement in the Middle East between the Arabs and Israel, not the Palestinians. But by doing that, it put the Palestinians in a position that they would ultimately and eventually have to come around, because their money bags were shutting down. The Gulf Arabs paid for the Palestinians to be cantankerous. And once the Gulf Arabs didn't want to pay for Palestinians anymore, the Palestinians would have been forced into a peace agreement with Israel. Now, that isn't going to happen because there's no second Trump term. But that was the plan, and it was brilliant. And I think they're, you know, Trump uncharacteristically modest about this achievement. And he said, well, this is sort of an achievement that hasn't happened in 20 or 30 years. I would say, how about a couple hundred? How about 1,000 years? Peace between Israel and the Arabs.
Indeed. KT, you've nicely teed up the compare and contrast. So let's turn to the Biden administration. Maybe as we talked initially about with you concerning Trump, the personnel is policy. As you say, there were legions of experienced, many of them, former Obama officials who were instantly installed into the key positions throughout the U.S. government, particularly in the national security and foreign policy space. How would you characterize, it's perhaps a sweeping generalization, but nonetheless, I think it's possible to do in this case, the sort of worldview and policy predilections of that team?
Well, it'll be America last, not America first. And they'll go back to that notion that, well, if we just help China, China will be peaceful. If we just get involved in the Middle East and we empower Iran, Iran will be a partner of ours. And it was wrongheaded then. It's even more wrongheaded now, particularly with regard to Iran. Iran, you know, they sold that Iran nuclear deal in the Biden administration as a way to stop Iran's nuclear program. It never did. It was just a pause. It just hit the pause button for 15 years.
Yeah, you said the Biden administration. I think you mean the Obama administration. The Biden administration is now going back to it. Well, yeah, that's what they say, the third Obama term. Yeah, and to that point, KT, when you look at the Iran deal, by its own terms, it's essentially done, but it hasn't kept the Iranians from pursuing their nuclear weapons ambitions. If anything, it's calculated by some to be a matter of perhaps weeks before they've got enough material to fashion at least one device. Some say they may already have them, but it didn't work out. And yet we're seeing this administration in its new form under Joe Biden and Kamala Harris insisting that we got to get back into that deal. And more to the point, as you were suggesting earlier, we have to embrace, we have to empower, we have to once again essentially make, from our perspective, the hegemonic power of the region Iran. It's hard to imagine a more foolish and reckless policy than that.
They've been given an golden opportunity, the Biden administration. Iran is in a desperate position. Their economy was already in bad shape because of low oil prices and because of Trump sanctions. The pandemic has hit them particularly hard because they have no public health system. And their leadership, you know, the mullahs who run Iran, they're in their 80s, they're in poor health, they're not going to last for long. And the Iranian people, they're not blaming America for their problems. They're blaming the mullahs. So it gives the Biden administration a golden opportunity to renegotiate a whole lot of things to keep Iran in its stable. But I fear that what they will do is go right back to the old Iran nuclear deal. And Iran will, as you point out, be in a position to have nuclear weapons in very short order. Turns out that even though they had everything to gain by that Iran nuclear deal, they were cheating at it anyway. And so what it will do is ignite a nuclear arms race in the Middle East.
And quite possibly a nuclear war. I think it's fair to say we're looking at that distinct possibility as the Israelis calculate that this existential threat is at hand, and they may well take steps to try to prevent it the old-fashioned way by nipping it in the bud. This brings me to one other area that we haven't talked about yet with UKT, and that I think is another dramatic difference between the Trump policy approach and that of Joe Biden. Talk a little bit about immigration and the policies that Trump pursued vis-a-vis Mexico and Guatemala and Honduras and so on to try to staunch the flow of illegal aliens into our country. And what's being done now?
Again, he's given the Biden administration a golden opportunity, which they will fail to seize. But especially after the pandemic hit, President Trump understood that you've got to continue to seal that border for a couple of reasons. One, illegal immigration coming into the United States depresses low-income workers. And the whole Trump economy lifted those low-income workers. At the bottom of the scale, all of a sudden had jobs and educational opportunities and prosperity. If you let an unrestrained stream of unskilled workers into the United States, they will compete and take the jobs from Americans. But the second issue now with the pandemic is the Biden administration is letting people into the United States without even checking them for coronavirus. They say they're overwhelmed. They don't have the ability to do the rapid test. But so what they're doing is, here we are, the nation is locked down. To the great detriment of the next generation of Americans, the kids who are in desperate need of going back to school. And yet what we're going to do is reintroduce potential pandemic right back into the United States.
Malfeasance, it seems to me, to be taking these kinds of steps, whether it's towards China, whether it's towards the Middle East, whether it's towards our own hemisphere. As you say, dashing opportunities that have been handed on the silver platter to golden platter, to use your metaphor, to a new administration, only to have it revert to policies that have clearly failed, and that if we abandon the ones that have been successful to this point, we set ourselves up for an even greater failure by far in the days ahead. Which brings me to, what do we do about this? And KT, we have to take another final break. And when we come back, I want to visit with you about what should America First Americans, what should Donald Trump supporters, what should Americans of other stripes, for that matter, be urging this new administration to do instead of going back to those failed policies, so as to, you know, actually protect the country we love and sure we can hand it on to our kids in as good a shape as possible. That will be topic A when we come back with KT McFarland right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the fourth and final installment of this fascinating conversation with KT McFarland. We have been covering with her own personal experience with trying to help craft and implement an America First foreign policy during the early days of the Trump administration, a contribution for which she has been recognized as recently as this weekend by the former president, and to describe in, I think, very clear-eyed terms what is now in prospect as a result of the change of administrations, the return to power of quite a number of people who were intimately involved in some of the failures of the Obama foreign policy and who seemed determined to repeat their mistakes in the present moment. Which, KT, brings us to the question that I think is probably on a lot of our minds, and that is, what do we do about this? How is it we can try to avoid unforced errors? And we're not just speculating about them being errors. We've seen this movie. We know what happens when you embolden the Palestinians, when you enrich the Iranians, when you underwrite the threat from communist China, when you essentially signal to untold millions or more of foreign nationals that America has open borders and will reward you for sneaking into our country, and so on. What, KT, must Americans who don't want those kinds of errors, those kinds of misbegotten policies to be imposed once again, do at the present moment?
Well, they say that history, you know, does history repeat itself? I don't think it repeats itself, but I do think it rhymes. And here's the rhyme, is that Joe Biden is Jimmy Carter, and their administration will fail, and it'll become very apparent within probably 6-9 months. It'll fail for a couple of reasons. One, they're going to ban fracking. They're going to raise taxes. Now, those two things are going to mean a lot more unemployment in the United States. The economy will not recover as it should post-pandemic. And you're going to start seeing things like gasoline is going to be, what, six, who knows how high it goes, gallons, dollars a gallon. And so the American people are going to be angry about that. And because the Biden administration has relied so much on the sort of dictatorship of the, you know, the slight majority telling the half of the country that it needs to be deprogrammed for supporting Donald Trump, they're going to own it. The people are going to look at the Biden administration and said, wait a minute, you know, the economy's bad. We're getting pushed around by China again. The Middle East is a crisis. We're going to probably have troops back in the Middle East. And they're going to blame the Biden administration. The second thing I would point out, though, is in the 2020 election, we've been so focused on the top of the ticket that no one has remarked on what happened down ballot, as they say. All across the country, candidates who ran on Trump policies of an improved economy, America first, peace through strength, make America great again, all of those candidates won overwhelmingly. I am in Florida, Sarasota, Florida. My daughter, Fiona McFarland, who you've known for decades, she's in her middle 30s. She ran for office in a Democrat district for the Florida State House of Representatives, and she won by 10 points because she campaigned on those same the Trump policies. And all across the country, well, thank you, but all across the country, this is happening. And the new Republican Party, the Trump Republican Party, is young. It's diverse. They're Hispanics. They're Blacks. They're women. They're veterans. And so our bench is great, and it shows by this election in 2020 that the American people actually aren't nuts, that they don't want to defund the police. They don't want to go have taxes. They don't want to have gasoline going up to $6 a gallon. So the country is there. It's just we have to have another election. And my guess is in 2022, the Democrats will have failed so miserably that Republicans can take the House and the Senate. You know, Margaret Thatcher, as you and I both knew her, and she said, first you win the argument and then you win the election. And so I think for the next 2 years, we've got to win the argument. Don't back down from America first and continue to make the case and then continue to encourage the people that Donald Trump mobilized to go to the polls. You know, that's the thing that no one gives credit to Trump for is that he got a whole percentage of the population who never voted before. He's gotten them engaged and he's gotten them inspired.
Yeah, you know, I just have to say, I don't disagree with any of those suggestions. I think they're absolutely right. But one must say it does not compute that all of those down ballot victories took place, that the people who espoused his policies and ran on his coattails won decisively, including in districts like your daughter's, where they weren't supposed to, you know, and he didn't win. Which brings us back to the current turmoil and impeachment and efforts to ensure that he can't ever run again. And more to the point, it brings us back to what I think you were just getting to, which is crucial. We need not only to make the case that America's policies should be aligned with those that Donald Trump espoused. And again, we're speaking in this context particularly of defense and foreign policy, but I think it applies more generally, the energy security, the, you know, business-friendly environment, you know, smaller regulatory footprint of the government, and so on. But it raises the question that must be addressed. If we don't learn what was done, I believe, to prevent Donald Trump from having the victory that he actually received from the voters, we will not have another free and fair election, whether it's in 2022 or whether it's 2024 or ever after, no matter what the voters want, because the books can and I fear will be cooked again. Well, that's a personal view, but I think, you know, the logic of what you've just said leads you inexorably to this question. How is it that a man who had these popular policies, who was bringing people from constituencies that had never voted before, in some cases, had never voted for Republicans before in substantial numbers, and that prompted this remarkable result in, you know, the federal and state and in some cases local elections, down ballot and so on. How on earth is it that he did not win a decisive victory as well? And more to the point, KT, and just toss this back to you to sort of tie this all up. Can we, in fact, avoid what Albert Einstein famously said was the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over again, meaning having votes like we did, not just in the presidential election in 2020, but in the Senate runoffs in Georgia, and not have similar kinds of outcomes, disenfranchising millions of us?
There's something, a bill called H.R. 1, that they're now going to debate at some point, and it basically solidifies the ability for people to steal elections. Because as President Trump said early on in the pandemic, is that mail-in voting is an opportunity for fraud. Even Amazon, which said that mail-in voting for president was just fine, they're not letting their employees have mail-in voting for whether to unionize.
Because it's fraught with fraud.
Look, I think as Republicans, we have to assume that they're going to cheat. And the naivete of Republicans going into the 2020 election, when President Trump said, look, is this going to be a problem? And I think the establishment of the Republican Party wasn't vigorous enough in pursuing that.
I don't think they wanted him to win, KT. And that's the bottom line, and I think that's what we're seeing in this impeachment business.
It's either incompetence or it's malfeasance, either one. But let's try to win this time, and it will be things like scrubbing voters' lists. And how do you do that in advance? Well, if this is a grassroots thing, but it's so important, every board of elections has a list of who's registered to vote. And you can get that list. Anybody can get that list. I can get that list. Get that list. Republicans locally, get that list. And then you, on your own nickel, you start going through the data and you start curating it. You know, you can do a Google search. Is John Jones on Broad Street? Is he still living on Broad Street? Oh, turns out John Jones died 20 years ago, but his name was never taken off the rolls. What about Susie Smith on Center Street? Is she still on Center Street? She's a registered Democrat. Well, turns out Susie Smith moved to another state 5 years ago, and her name was never taken off the rolls.
We're going to move off the air here momentarily. I'd have to wrap this up by just saying thank you for these specific prescriptions. And I think fighting H.R. 1, which is a topic we'll be speaking at length with the great Hans von Spakovsky about tomorrow, is really vital if we are to have free and fair elections in the future, unlike what I think happened to us just now. KT McFarland, thank you for all that you've done and will do. We appreciate you spending some time with us and hope that you'll come back to us again, often in 2021.
Pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
All the best. The best to you all, too. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow for Hans von Spakovsky and more. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.